Okay, so Sri suggested we keep these short, which is in a sense not a bad idea, and leave more time for discussion. So I've basically skinned this down to almost the bone, leaving a bit of background for those few that may not know what's what is going on in the game of understanding hypernovae properties, and then I'll leave you with some questions as Sri requested. So that is supposed to spur discussions. Okay, type 1c supernovae. Of course, the reason we talk about them is that they link to long duration gamma ray bursts, and the main topic here would be how do we determine their properties from the energetics to what is recently of more interest, the evidence that these things are aspherical. And indeed, actually, most Korkalov supernovae seem to be aspherical, and that could constitute a link to gamma ray bursts, although people may argue about it may not necessarily be enough. So the hypernovae compared to the type 1c supernovae spectra are here. We're talking optical spectra, sort of connecting to David Branch's talk a couple of weeks back. The classical, and I use the word because it was the only one reasonably well known, type 1c supernova spectrum is here. It hasn't got hydrogen or helium or strong silicon lines, and therefore it's thought to be the explosion of a stripped carbon oxygen core of a massive star. The mass of this object is supposed to be quite small, of the order of one solar mass in the ejecta, and the remnant is probably a neutron star. In the late 90s, actually, this was started here, 97EF, which was the first broad-lined type 1c supernova, was discovered when we were all, some of us were sitting here on a supernova workshop, and that's when some of us started to think about these spectra and what they could mean. Soon thereafter came 98BW, which was linked, of course, to the nearby weak gamma ray burst, 98 or 425. And later on, here's an example of O2AP, which is a well-observed nearby supernova. All of those have broad lines. And broad lines we interpret to mean high velocity of the ejecta of the supernova. By high velocity, we mean by no means relativistic velocities. We mean velocities of the order of 0.1, 0.2 c. So do not misunderstand this to mean that these are the spectra of relativistic ejecta. They're the spectra of material moving at most, let's say, 100,000 kilometers per second. If there is any higher velocity tail, it will not leave a signature on the spectrum because the mass involved is much too small to affect that. But in any case, the effect that you see because of the high velocity is that these features, which are fairly narrow in these ejecta here, in this spectrum, broaden out and eventually blend. So some of these peaks, which are not real emission lines, they're just P-Cygni emission profiles, are washed away because there is no low optical depth window in the spectrum for the emission photons to come out. So photons are scattered in a line. It may actually emerge, but it can't because it's then reabsorbing another line. And so it keeps scattering towards the red until it finally finds a gap in the optical depth, basically. And that gap tends to be the first one because of the composition and the atomic level structure past 5,000 angstrom. So that's why the spectrum looks so featureless. It is really a composition of a large number of lines, most of which are metal lines, iron by far dominating, cobalt, titanium, chromium, and so on, similar in a sense to the type 1As.
Oh, so you said that 98BW was the only one associated with the GRB?
At this point. So these typical well-observed light curves show that 98BW is brighter than your typical type 1c supernova. These other broad line supernovae with no gamma ray bursts aren't as bright. We've been arguing this may mean something. We'll get back to that in a bit. But certainly an object like 98BW is almost as bright as a type 1a supernova, indicating the synthesis of a fairly large mass of nickel 56, which is what powers the optical display. How do we go about that? It's very simple relations, which have now been used to even too much perhaps, but you can basically parameterize the width of the light curve using these three properties: the opacity in the ejecta, the mass in the ejecta, and the energy of the ejector. This is the same game you play in type 1a supernovae, only that there you keep this fixed. For the type 1c's, you're free to play with all three parameters. You assume that the opacity doesn't change very much because most of your ejector is supposed to be, well, carbon, oxygen, some iron that contributes the most. So it's really a game of mass and energy. And as you can see from that equation, this shape, this Leica, would be degenerate if you only had this way to get to it. So you have to solve the system using some other approach, and that is basically simulating and modeling the spectra, because the velocity, for instance, depends on the energy and the mass in a different way. And in any case, any given explosion model that may give you the same Leica would probably give you a different spectra. And so here's an example of the Leica of 98BW fitted by a number of models that all reproduce the Leica nicely. But if you then looked at the individual spectral fits that you would get, you would see that the low energetic ones, these ones up here, produce very narrow aligned spectra that do not look like the observations at all. And so our favorite model back then, and by and large still now, is something that has about 50 times 10 to the 51 ergs in spherical symmetry, this has to be pointed out, of kinetic energy. The mass in the ejector is of the order of 10 to 11. This indicates a very massive star. If the core was of the order of, say, 13, 14, assuming that this made a black hole, then the mass of the progenitor star was about 40 to 50 solar masses. The lines that contribute to the spectra I mentioned earlier, but they're marked here, there is actually a silicon line. People have gone about measuring the velocity of the ejector from this line. This is a very dangerous exercise that should not be attempted, I think, because the line is a blend. It's not clear where it forms. It's not easy to measure velocity. So don't believe too much when you see measurements of that line. You'll see one from me later, so don't believe that either. As time goes on, the spectra change. Instead of having a photosphere and the signal lines superposed onto it, the densities drop and the spectrum becomes nebular. So what you've got is emission in mostly forbidden lines of the elements that contribute to the abundances, so mostly iron here and oxygen. You can model that by basically assuming a single density and a non-LT model that matches the heating from the gamma ray deposition and the positrons deposition with cooling in forbidden line emission and derive an nickel mass, an average density, and so on. If you do this in a very simplified way, just as a one density gas, and try to fit the width of the oxygen line, the interesting thing about 98BW is that your iron lines are a bit too narrow. That's a bit of a contradiction, because in the typical stellar structure, you expect the oxygen to sit outside the iron core, and therefore you would think that the oxygen should be expanding more rapidly. The fact that you see this is telling us something. You can play the opposite game and fit the iron lines instead, and then you'll obviously overfit the oxygen line. So the oxygen seems to be moving at a lower velocity than the iron. And one way to reconcile these is something we came up with Ken. And,
Do you see the same thing in
94? You don't, actually. The nebular profile there is much more, let's say, all lines are parabolic, which indicates reasonably spherical distributions of the ejector. I'll show some other nebula spectrum. Okay, so a way to produce this configuration of narrow oxygen, broad iron lines, because you're looking at a transparent nebula where all that is there you can actually pick up, is, of course, to put the iron at a higher velocity than the oxygen. That's easy, right? So what you do is you produce a two-dimensional explosion model, which is what, thanks mostly to the work of Kenichi Maeda here, we did. And this is assumed to sort of simulate a jet-type explosion. I would say it looks like the iron is in a funnel. The oxygen is mostly distributed on a disk, or let's say the higher densities of the oxygen are on the equatorial plane of the exploding star. And if you're viewing this system from a direction that is near the direction of ejection of the iron, which was, of course, nickel 56, then you get the higher velocity from the iron, and the oxygen will be moving mostly tangentially to your line of sight, and so the oxygen line will not be very broad. And here is just to compare what the spherical situation would look like to what we're looking at in something like this. So this is a possible model to explain the supernova 98Pw with no relation to the GRB. Of course, the GRB, if it came off, it probably did come off in this direction, because I mean, we're looking from there, so must have seen it. Probably some other spectra. O2AP, I've shown some before, is a nice collection of spectra from various sources. A Likert model indicates a higher than normal energy and a higher mass than 94i, but not by any means as large as 98Pw. There was no gamma ray burst observed here. This was a very nearby event. So had there been anything, it would have been seen. There wasn't very much in the way of X-rays either, I think. Optical spectra fits with that model. And here is the nebula spectrum. The lines here are very narrow. They're all fairly narrow, indicating possibly some dense inner core. But there is no sign of this difference between the iron line velocity and the oxygen line velocity. All lines seem to have a narrow core. But otherwise, one velocity fits all, basically. So everything is fairly smooth. Everything is fairly homogeneously distributed, so it seems. The nickel production, 56 nickel production, was also a lot less than in 98Pw, as we could see from the light curve earlier on. This is just a table to recap some properties, which I think is interesting because it shows you that you only ever see the gamma ray burst in the most massive event, most energetic that we know of. And as you go down, these would all be called, in our definition, hypernovae, because they have the broad lines, but there's no signature of any relativistic event in those. And if you look at the physical properties, there's almost a continuum going up from the classical low energy 94i to 202AP and all the way.
I want to ponder this. Is 94i, I mean, this looks a lot like 91BG, the light curve. So tell me why 94i can't be a thermonuclear event. I mean, the ejected mass is small,
Well, you deduce a mass that is not Chandrasekhar. This may not mean very much.
Yeah,
it could still be. Yeah, if it doesn't bother you, then fine. You don't see, but it may just not be excited, so you may not see it. You don't see the typical sulfur lines that are seen in 1A spectra, but you can also argue that away by saying the temperature isn't high enough. I would think that the one thing that gives, that would, should make you ponder, is the fact that 94i, like O2AP, has a strong oxygen line. Okay, 1As in general don't have that. 91BG doesn't have that line. Oxygen is supposed to be in the white dwarf, but no 1A has ever been seen with a strong oxygen line in the nebula phase, meaning the oxygen is successively burned to silicon, most likely. If you can find a way not to burn the oxygen, leave it there, then I have no answer. This may well be a 1A. But it will be a very strange 1A, but yeah. This is the evidence.
But I mean, I guess the reason is, that's good.
Do we know their oxisol?
Oh, this doesn't seem to have a very well-defined axis. I mean, but we do see higher velocity material coming to us, so likely we were not viewing this thing very far from its symmetry axis, if you had one. Because it would be difficult to imagine that the ejector were going much faster than what we've seen in our direction. But it could be spherical. I would not think it is aspherical and not pointing to us, because that would lead you to very high velocities. It would make it more likely for a GRB to have been there, and there's no signature of that off-axis or whatever. So.
Narrow iron lines and
drug
oxygen lines, as you might expect if you
line up drug. No. You see, the widths are always fairly similar, indicating the iron mixes out fairly well. The oxygen lines can have funny shapes, but the iron lines are always fairly broad as the oxygen lines. I think there's no great difference between them. So the iron mixes out, the nickel mixes out fairly effectively, it seems. And the velocity difference between the bulk of the iron and the bulk of the oxygen is small.
Well,
we'll see some later.
That's the more minor questions.
Okay, more signatures of asphericity. This is again work with Kei Shimaeda, right? We have reference here. And this is the shape of the light curves. Initially it has been a bit of a struggle for people that model light curves to reproduce these funny shapes, because the light curves look like type 1a light curves initially. They fast rise, fast decline, but then light curves of 1a sort of settle late on a tail like that, and these kind of become linear in the magnitude versus time plot. They're basically a straight line, and that's not easy to get with a simple model. So one attempt here was to place like a sphere of dense material in the middle that is effective in absorbing gamma rays and delays the rate time decline of the light curve. That's of course a construction, but it kind of goes to indicate that there is something that is not moving at very high velocity and that contains quite a bit of the nickel. And this is again a one-dimensional picture, but I think if we translate it into 2D, it means that some of the bulk of the ejecta are not coming out at a very high velocity. And this is common actually to all of these. It's common to 90ABW and O2AP, although the magnitudes and the energies and so on are very, very different. 97EF is here as a really special case with a very, very massive core by comparison. But it's interesting that these two events look so similar, and the ratios of the masses that we deduced in the high velocity and low velocity components are actually quite similar. So, you know, something underneath may be quite similar in these events. 90ABW is not the only supernova linked to a GRB, but it's the best observed. This is the second best, O3DH, GRB 03, 0329. This is a nebula spectrum. This is the best that they could get. So, I mean, if you're a keen observer, you'll see some lines there. You call this oxygen, you call this sort of the iron. And you can fit it with a model that looks similar to 90ABW, but, you know, it's nowhere near as good to the diagnostics, basically. But the properties are the same. The oxygen line is narrow. The iron line is apparently much broader. So having collected a few of these models, I think we're now in a position to produce a diagram like this, which has been around now for some time, which attempts to show a trend that we thought we saw in these supernovae. People have been contradicting this, I think. If we restrict our sample to objects that are well studied, this still holds. As you go up in ejected nickel mass, you also go up in main sequence mass if you're on the type 1c branch. The behavior is opposite for the type 2, so the hydrogen-rich supernovae. And we put this black hole to neutron star dividing line there to emphasize what may be the mechanism behind the differences in going up in energy as you go up in mass. The same relation holds if you compare the energy, if you plot the energy against the main sequence mass. It's even clearer, actually. The energies go up as the main sequence, the reduced main sequence mass goes up. And so something like O2AP seems to be a borderline case between a neutron star versus a black hole remnant and objects higher up. The red ones here are the ones with gamma ray bursts have higher energies. The rates have been discussed, so I don't think there's any point in my taking any time since we want to do it quickly, but there is this tantalizing evidence that the numbers, the exponent of the number is similar. I'd say it's all in that. And then you can add any fudge factors as you like. I mean, you can make this inefficient, and then you can include changing IMFs and stuff. So you can still make those exponents come out to be the same. So it still is interesting. Small questions. What are events like these? Are they real? There's a detection of what is thought to be a normal spectrum, a normal 94i type spectrum, in the afterglow, well, in the rebrightening of the afterglow of a GRB at a cosmological distance, Z of about 1, I think, in this case. This argument, this evidence, is based on, you know, 1,500 angstroms worth of a spectrum with probably very low signal to noise. This feature that is the basic for this ID is a calcium feature, which is common to basically any supernova, not just type 1c's. So I'm not quite sure what to make of this. It has been suggested it is, it's out there. But if this was true, it would indicate that weak supernovae like 94i, the I's missing there, of course, also make gamma ray bursts, and by no means weak gamma ray bursts. More evidence of strange things, X-ray flashes with a very brightening, and there is no real spectrum there, there's only noise. But a fit to the light curve indicates, again, a supernova sort of like 94i, or maybe slightly better, O2AP. This was, again, work done by the Tokyo group. This is, again, you know, it's interesting. An X-ray flash is, of course, not a gamma ray burst, but it's also a high energetic event. And if that also has a supernova, there may be a general correlation between core collapse and relativistic events. That's one of the examples we've seen. I think we have a couple more, but in none have we got a real nice spectrum or spectral coverage, better still, that would allow us to determine the properties of the supernova, and really to say, yes, there was a supernova. Velocities. I've included here not only the two cases I've discussed, but this latest one, O3LW, which is GABO3-1203. And again, it's noisy data, but you can do a reasonable job of fitting the spectra. And you deduce energies that are similar to BW or O3DH. And the one thing that these things have is the velocities of, this is not the measured line, this is the line, the velocities used to model the spectra. So I would, from my own point of view, argue that these velocities would make a bit more sense than just looking at a spectra and measuring a wavelength. The velocities do go up as you increase total energy, of course, you know that. So that's not unexpected. Now, some of the problems. The problems come when one looks at the X-rays, gamma rays properties of these various events. These are the three GAB supernovae in the X-rays from basically the beginning to 2 or 3 years after. And they start from very different values. So 98BW had very low X-ray luminosity, and then the progression to 03DH, not 02, which looked basically, I think, almost like a normal gamma ray burst in its X-ray afterglow. So is that telling us anything? Is this possibly a signature of intrinsic differences in the gamma ray burst? Is it telling us something about the orientation of these things? There's been a debate, of course, going on. At later phases, they all sort of seem to fall together, which may not tell us very much, except everything is dying out. So just to recap. Ah, nice. My time, well, I may as well leave them all there, because the order is obviously not what it should be. So signatures of ray sphericity, the presence of an in-dense core, and the fact that the iron lines are broader than the oxygen lines, I think, are the most striking effects on the supernovae themselves, forgetting about the fact that they are linked to gamma ray bursts. So the fact that this low signal-to-noise line in O3DH seems to be narrower than that of 98BW suggests that either the supernova is even more spherical than that, or the viewing angle is even closer to the gamma ray burst axis, which would actually make sense given that the GAB associated with this supernova was stronger, I think, than the GAB associated with that. But it's only a suggestion again. These are not the only spherical supernovae. We know that to some degree, basically all core collapse supernovae have asphericity, even classical core collapses. There's papers, I don't know if it's come out yet, but looking at the polarization inside, and only one sees which are polarized, but core collapse supernovae with hydrogen envelopes. And following the polarization as it turns on when the photosphere moves inside of the helium layers. And so when you approach the carbon oxygen core, the polarization suddenly goes up, indicating that possibly the mechanism that was behind the core collapse was similarly aspherical in a type 2 supernova. So the fact that we see polarization nicely in the type 1c is only because of the lack of the hydrogen envelope covering up that evidence early on. Okay, this one was also a debated case. What we've been doing is, because of these indications, we've been trying to take early and late time spectra of as many 1Cs as we could lay our hands on, sort of doing the same that Shree's doing in the radio and deriving properties of the supernovae from that. This is an interesting case because early on he had reasonably broad lines, sort of like O2AP, so it was an interesting target. We followed it up into the nebula phase, and we suggest that it was an aspherical event again, but viewed very much off axis. What gives that away is now again the shape of the oxygen line, which is double peak, and the thick line is a model that is obtained from the exact same model that fitted the 98BW spectrum, only tilted sideways, so that we have an equatorial view. And because the oxygen is coming out mostly on the disk, the oxygen line develops, from our point of view, a double peak. Where the characteristic velocity here, and I should say that because there was a question before, is of the order of 7,000 kilometers per second, which is not that high. So was O3JD an off-axis event exactly the same as 98BW? It was similarly bright. Indications that it could be the same. Well, that was our picture. If you look at this phenomenon, say, from the polar axis, you see a narrow line. If you look at it from the equatorial axis, you see the double structure. So we have no observations. We try to put limits. Enrico Ramirez-Ruiz did a calculation of the off-axis properties of GOBs, and assuming we have a viewing angle of about 60, 70 degrees, he could place upper limits to just upper limits observations that basically did not contradict the possibility there may have been X-rays and radio from a GOB if the angle was sufficiently large. However, later observations from...
Which is
there here. Blue is radio and red is X-ray. So Alicia Soderbergh's later points also find no radio at times when the radio should have peaked had the supernova had a gamma ray burst and had it been viewed 60 degrees from the axis. So the evidence of radio, the absence of radio is taken to indicate that there was no gamma ray burst, and this may well be. On the other hand, the supernova has properties that are very similar to those of 98BW. So at this point we're faced with this problem. Does every 98BW have a GOB, or was that a fluke? Of course, 98BW was only ever discovered because there was a GOB. O3JD was discovered because it was a bright nearby supernova. We know of basically no other 98BW that came without a GOB. So you work out the numbers. It may be that in your sample so far you have not had a single bright type 1C close enough and pointing at you that was not accompanied by a GOB. But I mean, it gets a little difficult to do all that. Back to the X-ray properties, just to emphasize this again, the properties are very different from object to object. So O3DH looks fairly normal for a non-axis, almost an on-axis GOB afterglow. And then as you go to O3LW, it seems to indicate a slightly larger angle, 98BW a larger angle still, and then the non-GOB supernovae are lower down here, 94I, O2AP is the invisible light blue dots. These are type 2, so I wouldn't be so worried about those, but this is an interesting, possibly coincidence. I don't know what people make of this, but it is nice. The radio, however, doesn't seem to suggest that this is just the same, normalizing it. The radio properties, are nowhere. Basically, most of these objects, Shree and group, have looked at every 1C they could observe, and they've been much more efficient than we have been because radio, they don't have problems with day or night and stuff. But basically, they don't see radio to the degree they should expect in just about any object at all. They've looked at all 1Cs. I would say, well, okay, if it's a normal 1C, you don't expect a lot of radio, but they've got a few hypernovae, a few supposedly hypernovae in their sample, and yet they see nothing. So what does that mean? Does it mean there is no jet? Does it mean the environment is not as dense as it has been assumed to be for the classical GMBs. Why do the supernovae that should come with the GMBs not follow the same trend that we see in the GMBs? So are they really associated, or is it just a weak low energy tail of the GMB phenomenon? On our side, we've been, this is unfortunately not so clear, but we just got it from, anyway, I'll try and tell you what this is, but it's a collection of late time spectra of type 1 C of various kinds obtained through our program at Subaru, showing, and this is what, you know, one should focus on, unfortunately it's not really very clear, the oxygen profiles are here, and what this goes to show is there are other objects with these double peak profiles, not just the one that we've written about, not just the 3DJ. So this is something that happens quite often. I think you can see it maybe most clearly here. So once you have a good enough sample, you see a distribution of spectral properties in the oxygen line, indicating that this disk jet configuration is fairly common in type 1C supernovae. Probably most of them are, to some degree, aspherical. It may be the asphericity increases as the energy increases. That's something we haven't looked at yet, because one has to derive the various energies for the supernovae, but that is a possibility. However, none of these events had a GMB or were detected in the radio by Alicia and Sri and crowd. So we face a dilemma, I think, here. And so I'll just leave you with these three basic questions that Sri asked me to write down. So are all long GMBs hypernovae? I think the evidence we have is a bit shaky. It is true that the nearest GMBs all have supernovae, and the supernovae are hypernovae. We know very little about the more distant GMBs. We have no idea why the gamma ray, X-ray, radio properties are so different. Orientation is a possibility, but in the radio that's been argued against. And so what is actually going on? I just said that are the cosmological GMBs the same, or are they a different family and they just, you know, seem to fall in the same basket because we just have gamma ray detectors? And nearby we detect the more frequent but intrinsically weaker events. One possibility here would be to try and find a good supernova in a GMB at Z of 1. I mean, this is something that shouldn't be an impossible effort. Type 1A supernovae are similarly bright and they are regularly found at this redshift. So there is, in principle, no reason that good type 1Cs should not be discovered at this redshift, especially if you have a GMB trigger. You have about 1 month before the supernova rises to peak. So, I mean, that's something that should be attempted at some point. And I mean not just taking a Leica, because that's easy. I mean, you can have all sorts of, I want spectra. I want something that tells me this is a supernova, it has this content, it has this chemistry, it has these velocities in UJ. A question more for the theorists, I think, is what are really the off-axis properties of gamma ray bursts? Why is there this discrepancy between the expected radio flux in particular and the apparent lack of any in the observations? I could turn the question around and ask Sri why you never see anything in the radio. Did you turn your instrument on? But, you know, I don't want to be Sri, because he's much better to be provocative. A side question to that is, are XRFs of off-axis GMBs? I think once we have the question to the first line, we also will have one for the second line. And then, of course, yeah, where is the radio? Where is it gone? You know. And I think this is something that is, that bugs me, really. Why is the radio only ever seen where the gamma rays are seen? And it's not just like you see some supernovae that have radio and no gamma. There is not one case of that. In your completely random sample of one season, is not one case of radio without gamma. So, yeah. Is there a jet? Is there no jet? Okay, and then the final question, I have no comments on that, because I think it is interesting that we know so little. Are these the first stars? Are these, whatever these are, Z equals 5, roughly, I mean, the furthest GMBs. So to my mind, okay, these are the three questions that I would like to leave you with, but you know, people may have different ideas. So I've been almost good at keeping my time. Thanks.
I have a question with that plot where you have the hypernova going, the bifurcation plot where you have the hypernova going up. Is it really true that if you had something that was a hypernova energy and it would, had some hydrogen on it, can you say that you just, it would not show up as a weird supernova? Why don't we see any weird type 2 stars?
This one here.
And then the other issue is, why don't we see any weak 1BC ones? Is it just we don't see? It's the bifurcation plot where we have...
Oh, you want the other one. Right, the energy plot. I see what you mean, yeah.
That one there. When you have... What would it, if I took an energetic star, you know, energetic explosion and put it in a... Type 2 in a star with a hydrogen envelope, where would it appear if it was in this 20 to 30 solar mass?
It would probably appear if it had a lot of energy, okay, and it was type 2. You would still know if it was a large mass, so you would infer the energy from thinking like the tank. You get a large energy, you get
a large ejector mass, you infer a big massive progenitor, you put it up there. So there are no cases.
So then I would almost say, I mean, I'm going to extrapolate here, and people can start crucifying me as soon as they want. Keter, you almost, I would go, okay, I'm making my 1C in a binary. I almost say I need a binary to somehow make that strong explosion.
I could not agree more.
It would almost, to me, be the proof. I mean, anybody that gives me a single star model.
You're still, you should be giggling, right?
You know, for something like this, I would say, well, how do you do this? Because you, a single star model is likely to have some objects
yeah.
that have a hydrogen envelope.
Yeah. However, there's this recent paper from the Berkeley group arguing they find nice, as I said, evidence for asphericity in the way of increasing polarization in the core of a type 2.
I still think type 2s are aspherical, but I...
But the energy there is about one-fold, the energy here is much more.
Yeah, we have some 1B1C, all 1B1Cs are aspherical, you know, we see a lot of aspherical in all 1B1Cs, but not all of them are hypernova.
Yeah.
And then the other question is, are there any weak 1B1Cs, or is the sample just too small? Or can you say there's no weak 1B1Cs?
We don't have very much in the way of good data. I think 94i basically sets the limit. The ejector mass here is about one solar mass. It's difficult to have anything less than that. You may miss them because they may be too faint. That is a possibility. If there's anything that is weaker than that, if it's not just the energy, because that would make life broad, if it was just also a reduction in the nickel production, then you may easily miss those. That's a possibility. But the fact that this mass here is very small, and the masses go up as the energy goes up, seems to mean that, you know, that's about the hard limit. So, I don't know.
I had a few questions on many of your plots. Like this one, for example, you make the point that the energy goes up, the mass goes up, the main sequence mass. But how do you derive this main sequence mass at all? Most of it just comes from, like, I mean, if you look at almost any star like above 40, 50 solar masses is probably going to end its life at 10 solar masses or something. You get an ejector mass and you're probably deriving it from there, or how? Because I don't know if that top part really, you know, whether you can say it's 40, 50, 60, 80 or anything.
Well, we have
rising from mass. Yeah. Total information. Yeah, without mass,
We assume the core mass is proportional to the 0H main sequence mass of the star.
Sure, okay, but I'm saying that, you know, there are many different things, like, you know, a star will lose mass, and then you might have the same remnant mass or something, or a core mass, without even having...
But you're not going to make a 10 solar mass carbon oxygen core from a 12 solar mass star.
No, but...
So, I mean...
What I'm saying is you could make it from either a 35 or a 60 or something. I don't know if there's much difference there, and that's what I'm saying. Is there, can you really tell that...
Ken, you've done these models. There seems to be a difference. I mean, you would not land at exactly the same value, would you? I mean, the CO mass, the CO core mass, would not be exactly the same if you start at 30 or 60.
The CO core mass depends on the Coriolis mass. We identified Coriolis mass, missing gas mass, from the CO core.
Okay, yeah, but still, okay, anyway, we
get... I mean, this is certainly a subject of uncertainty, but...
I think this is a fair point, that there could be a principle coming from somewhat more massive.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
They did not develop a massive carbon oxygen core, or that lost
just
some of that?
Lost some of the carbon oxygen. Yeah, it could be almost anything, it could be almost anything above that, I'm just saying...
It could be anything above it, yeah, okay, if you...
I don't know, but...
One interesting point here would be, and admittedly, we've not seen any presence of helium telling you how much of the CO core has been lost. That has been argued, but I would not buy that. So if you saw any helium, you'd say, well, you've just about stripped the helium envelope. But yeah, there may have been CO core parts of that lost before. So I mean, this may be taken as a lower limit, if you wish. But.
And also another thing about, you're talking about, you know, the radio and the fact that the radio is less than expected or something. How do you expect the radio? Like, what do you do? What was used to figure out what the radio should be or something? Or like, what kind of, how do you use parameters to figure out what?
Yes, I mean, many parameters are used. I'm not the person who does these models, but people do this, base these on an assumption about the velocity and the mass loss in the progenitor star to assume what the supersonic medium should be like.
And on the thing, and, you know, one
canonical model has been used to do this.
More reasonable approach would be to actually use observed cases where radio emission was observed.
Yeah.
And then try to see.
So this maybe should be done by the people who have these models and see what parameters really are.
From various I'm pretty sure that even in that case, in many cases, the upper limit would be tighter. Then basically you just need less energy and more resistance check, which might very well be the case.
But the thing
probably
is...
Probably a distribution of energy as a function of Lorentz factor. In the top end you have gamma inverse, so you have a whole lot of energy in high level to this material, but you probably have many more cases where you have more moderate energy and more moderate Lorentz factor.
But, I don't know, maybe Shri can address the question of how they actually, you did some of the, or Alicia did, I guess, some of these models?
Yeah, but, you know, what I think the best example is what Paulo showed the luminosity plots, that they speak for themselves, right? It's sort of like, you know, so let's just look even at the X-ray, because the X-ray plot doesn't have a radio here, but, yeah, that's fantastic. The X-ray. X-ray is you know there's another one you had the three X-ray light because one which fell down power law had a little flat and then a little more matter. But the point is that at late times they all are not too different. I mean, I think it's actually because there's some advantage in measurements, and because you also have the spot. So I think this is the revealing plot that there are the ones we think see the GRBs are pretty bright, and the other ones, 2002 AP would hardly, you know. I mean, the only reason there is a detection is it just happens to be next door. In that way.
Right. So I mean, from my point of view, I think it things should be expressed in physical units, such as luminosity, not flux, because one is confused.
This is empirically, it's very clear. So I'd like to come to the question you have here. The second question is, you know, what's so special about these things? So I think we saw things which are GRBs are also bright in X-ray, also bright in radio. And I think that's mainly because, obviously, they have very fast-moving electrons generated.
So you're talking about the GRBs.
These guys, they're bright in
everything. Or just this one, because, I mean, there's this big difference here.
Nonetheless, they're still bright compared to
the low
other samples
tail.
You had in the end, you know.
Yes.
They show oxygen lines, they do this, they do that, sometimes they have high velocity. So let's group as ones with sort of GRB detection and ones which look interesting optical. I mean, they're sort of two
simple
samples.
Right.
where do you start from? And your initial thing is, I started the GRP sample, that's one group, okay, it's a small group, actually. And the other one is, I started because it looks interesting to me as an optical observer. I see lines, I see sometimes horns, or things which I can interpret as something very interesting going on, which is a valid approach, do not deny that. But the subsequent properties, the two groups seem like doing their own separate thing.
Yeah, except they overlap.
Well,
in a few
options. I just want to consider this as the first group because they've all been triggered by some gamma rays.
Sure, yes.
And so...
But so then the point with something like O3JD or possibly these other ones...
Yeah, which is called the other group.
If you'd been sitting on a planet that the axis was pointing at, would you have had your X-ray, gamma ray detectors triggering on that or not? You tell me no.
Since I can't do that experiment, let me do the other way around. You know, the axis unfortunately is fixed for me.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sitting here, not on another planet. The question is, so the question really is, 2003 JD looks interesting from other perspectives. Does it at any time make an appearance on this plot or on the radio plot? And the answer now, we know.
There's no.
The answer is no.
Yeah.
So, there's no masquerading going on here, at least in my mind, empirically. I mean,
where would the upper limits be on this plot? Would they be fairly different than the daytime observations here?
Oh, for these, yeah, for these nearby, these are very large distance. Yeah. I mean, even, okay, DW is the faintest of the lot, but these other two guys are great distance. So we can make a plot. We made this in the radio, and it's pretty clear that the.
Yeah.
That the radio luminosity of these objects at any given epoch of nearby objects, 2003 JD, 2002 AP, then absolutely radio quiet. Now, this is an epoch dependent question. You want to do this one day after the first, 1 month, 1 year, 10 years, because maybe there are things that are coming into the beam. And
well, these curves, okay, in the regular they do go up. In the X-rays they never go up, in the regular they come up. But then, these look like your classical supernova interacting with circumstellar material. You do not require a jet to model these. I mean, Kurt Weiler and people have been modeling these for years successfully.
Yes. Yeah. Again, we'll assume that when we do detect the radio, we have the ability to distinguish it arising in a usual fashion versus a faster moving jet. Yeah, because it's not many which are detected routinely in radio, even in the nearby sample. They do need higher density or proximity.
Right, so can this help us distinguish, let's say, O3JD from 98BW? Since the only difference seems to have been the fact that one made weak gammas and radio,
yeah,
and the other
didn't? The simplest conclusion that in my mind is that separate beats, actually.
Mm-hmm. But yet, from the supernova point of view, they're very similar.
Yeah, so that's what I keep. That's unfortunately. So I would say, well, you guys are dealing with some supernova weather.
Or are you dealing with the weather? Is that the weather?
I don't know, because to produce that, it's just rare, and so it takes more energy. It's the most spectacular events have these outputs. So that's only. That's why I said, you know, I'm happy using X-ray or radio because
yeah.
They trace high Lorentz factor material, which seems to be a part of this engine business.
Well, I mean, one could introduce again this fudge factor, saying only so many of these events ever make relativistic, ever produce relativistic ejecta, and those are the ones that make GRBs and the vast majority don't do that for some reason that we don't know because the clouds up there aren't favorable to it, and then you can have, you know, BW, which we only saw because there was a GRB pointing to us, or JD.
Didn't you have the rates of hypernova and GRBs?
Right, but then you have a different population of GRBs that goes in. And if you say that only maybe 10% of these may be GRBs, then 90% of the GRBs are not this, there's something else.
Have you got comfortable with what fraction of the type 1 DC produce hypernovae according to this calculation?
Oh, about 5%.
5%?
Yeah.
Do you need like 1 in 1,000 to produce a gamma ray?
No, we have assumed in that calculation that every hypernova makes a gamma ray burst.
Well, so the Soderberg et al. Says that can't be that.
Well, but she compares every 1BC, okay? And we don't do that. We take 5%.
But don't you need, in order to get the right to rate of Yama reverse, about 1 in 2,000 1BC?
Yeah, probably. Work that number out. This. This tells you 5%, and they're favored because they're brighter. So eventually, it means you're viewing like 1 every 100 of 1BC, is not 1 every 2,000. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that depend on the opening angle you've seen as well? Because to go from 1 every 100 to 1 every 1,000 is a big change. So either this rate is different from what we've used, or that rate is different. Yeah, we should do that.
So the idea that you're going to get some hypernova that don't make relativistic jets, that can be just the fact that you need, if you don't have the right angular momentum, you don't get a nice relativistic jet. So if the angular momentum, I don't know what these look like, but there's lots of ways of making something that's still going to be a very asymmetric, strong explosion.
Yeah.
But it may not produce a very successful jet. So I think it's not hard to imagine in a theory way, and that's only given you in series in the mechanism game. So assuming we're not doing anything serious in the mechanism game, it's not hard to say, look.
Okay, then if this point is true, that the rate here is smaller, so that it's a smaller fraction that you need, then it's okay to reduce this fraction. You still can make the two vectors.
And then an interesting question to answer is if we can get the rates better, that would actually be something that constrains the mechanism.
Well, so you need better rates, you need a better estimate of the opening angle, which is...
Yeah, that's the only...
This is bigger than that, actually, because, I mean, the square of that.
It's the same problem we're having with how do you produce a magnetar, because the magnetar rate is not known.
So, I mean, this was just an indication that, I mean, the two figures seem to fall basically in the same ballpark, but apart from that, there's an easy factor of 10 on either of these, I think, that can go up or down, and then you're free to choose any fudge factor you want at this stage. But there should be some foundation for doing this, so maybe what you say is the way to...
Yeah, I was hoping to go the other way. You get an observed rate that you get more accurate, so you can tell the mechanism people what they should be.
Yeah. But that usually works asymptotically. I mean, things improve, but they don't vastly change.
Yeah.
Observational rates. So, they may change
that. Show one plot, which is sort of the other half of the question, are all long-duration GRPs accompanied by bright supernovae? I can only show because I can't
see. You want to put your... Thank you, sir. Yeah.
That plot, which I thought you would have been showing. So.
Well, she was going to help that. Let me just ask. So I'm sure I understand the definition. So you have this hypernova is 5% of 1B1C. Is that a velocity cut, an energy cut? What's the?
It's a bit of everything. It's the number that have these broad line spectra, basically.
Okay, if I looked at day 5 and I plotted up all the velocities of all 1BCs at some fixed time, what the distribution look like? Is it bimodal? What's it look like?
Given that we don't have very many objects, because unfortunately people have been looking mostly at the high velocity ones, I would think it's a continuum with reduced numbers as the velocities go up. So there are many more objects with low velocities than objects with high velocity.
Right. So I'm trying to understand, if you only had the optical data, getting back to this question Tree was asking about where do you see the contrast, just from the optical data you're saying, you'd see a continuum of properties at early times. What about at late times?
Late times, all of these things have strong oxygen emission.
Yeah.
The second most important feature is the iron emission line, which is almost invisible in the normal 1Cs because they don't make very much nickel. And as you go up, the iron line starts coming up. So that is the main difference in the late times. Then within that group, you observe a different profile.
But does the late time, so I'm asking, does the late time nebular spectroscopy correlate with the initial velocity you saw?
Yeah. So the high velocity events are the ones with iron in the late phase.
Yeah, got it.
That's the correlation, I would say, safe.
Okay.
basically you're claiming that because of observational bias, because it's hypernova brighter, and if you observe
look at, oh yeah, if it's a standard one, if Alex puts out a circular saying it's a 1C, you can't get anybody to observe it unless he says it's BW light, and everybody wants to observe it.
What I'm saying is that you argue that about 1 in 1,000 1BC is in fact it's a hypernova, because they're brighter and therefore you see the
1 in 100.
So 5% is observational.
Yes, and so no, but you've got another factor of 3 to 5 because of brightness, so that takes you down to 1%, not 1 in 1,000. Because these things are discovered, they're not followed, but they are discovered. Oh yeah, I didn't want to show that, of course.
Yes, I don't know for the reasons, but let me show. So this is your first question. Are they accompanied by supernovae? But it's hard to keep hoping Smith will find a BW every other probably every century. So they make do with the more distant ones, and the only thing you can get is the best work you can really do is with the redshift of even 0.5 with HST, and you get 5 points, so you throw in a little curve, try to get a peak thing, that's it's rough here. Anyway, so this is sort of the thing that Alicia has, and probably she talked at her workshop in more detail, and you must have seen her previous talk also in the last GLB meeting, a little bit. So what this shows, so let's not focus too much on sort of the important mass and all that. I mean, you know, it's sort of an exercise like what Paul went through, showing the time scale of photon diffusion and the typical velocity. That's how those numbers are produced. Nonetheless, let's just simply focus on even more crude things, which is the peak, the inferred peak V-band flux corrected in for some of these directions, by 4.8 or even 1. And there are two samples. One is a local 1BC sample in yellow, and then the GRB XRF associated supernova sample, which is actually been growing. Unfortunately, that sample is reaching hard ever since Hubble went into the 2-gyro model. But yeah, I'm sorry, but Alicia likes this slightly more point by point thing. So let me. Okay, we'll skip all this. The point here is that there are a few of these GRBs which are actually, they're not all bright. They're sort of, because VW is so bright, has had large velocities, there's this idea that the supernovae that accompany GRBs. And I'd like to make a distinction. I'd like to say we should use somewhat different word. If someone wants to say they have larger velocities in broad lines, which is a technical observation, and maybe saying hypervelocity would be better. It says exactly what you're trying to say, or even better, to draw lines if you don't like read or something. Say hypernova and or anything that is in the kitchen sink is confusing because not your one man's hypernova is another man's ordinary nova kind of a thing. So hypernova probably should be used for these genuinely, you know, 10-4 events which are genuinely bright in an energetic sense. Because the hyper is qualifying the word nova, and that's usually what we mean. So something that bright here would, at least observationally, should be called as a hypernova, supernova, and a nova. Anyway, so yeah, there's a distribution here. You know, that it was bright there. There's some other one. I don't know which one that is. I'm not much into the supernova statistics and names. And there's some which I think here, and a couple of XRFs here. So you can then do a KS test. This all the sample you have. Yeah, and here I can see exactly what the KS test tells you. They're not very different samples. So the idea that supernovae from associated with GRBs are something very special, they always have a white lines, they always are brighter, I think that's not true. And I know that many of you guys in the supernova community would like to believe they're very, very special.
Yeah, well, my point for actually not including this stuff and making you come up and show it yourself was I've talked about the ones that have good spectrum light curves and gamma ray burst signatures at the same time. Some of these are bumps in light curves.
Well, that's all you for a long
time. But I think
at redshift 0.7, you're not going to, you'll see at least bumps are now, you know, they're well established. You can
but you can simulate those light curves with any kind of combination of mass and energy.
Oh yeah, yes.
You can say they're bright. It's just the brightness.
That's what I'm saying. Forget the top part. I just look at the bottom part. It's very simple. Are the supernovae, the peak magnitude, similar? Are they always bright? The answer is no. I don't care the details, because I can't right now. It's a reasonable thing to do when you don't have much data, and it's not going to change.
Well, if the lack of data is then responsible for the fact that none of the local, really local, meaning like the optical frequencies, have any radio, then that may hold. But otherwise, why is there no radio in any of these? And again, you find normal supernovae associated with GABs at higher redshifts.
Because they're rare.
That's what I'm saying. If the numbers are still sort of too low, then fine. But
I mean, galactic center is a completely pathetic black hole in some ways. But things that are abounding in our neighborhood, almost any special galaxy has a black hole.
But this
guy, you have to go to high redshift to get a blazar. It's a fact. Almost brightest objects in astronomy are.
Yeah, but here we do have some idea about the expected rate of 1BC supernovae and so on. So one could actually try and work out of how many supernovae in that volume or that redshift.
You know that answer. It's 1 in 100. So we looked at 100 supernovae in radio. At some point, you should start getting the thing by chance. Yes. Yeah, but it would be better if you'd done 1,000, then the statistics would be...
Yeah, of course the numbers work against you if you want to include all 1Cs, because then your sample becomes...
For many of these 100, the limits are not that great, so one word to be more careful to say an upper limit at 10% currently.
Yeah, but the part I guess I slightly find, at least it's a question of philosophy, is that when you see that's in the fixed idea of what the religion here is, and then you're trying to see everything in terms of that religion, so...
What is that religion?
The religion here is that hypernovae are bright, they have velocities that produce more nickel, and they produce GRBs, there's a universal jet. I think this is arguably the ultimate unified religion, and then everything is derived from that. I don't think so. I think this is a much more deviant phenomena.
It's not division. Theoretically, the difficult part is here. If the exploited energy is more than 1 fourth or 1 beta, then it's very difficult to get produce this amount of nickel in theoretical way.
Yeah, so
that's a big question for me.
Did all these nickel units, right? Did you get created?
Oh, forget that. Because I don't know. Because
that this brightness is very difficult to do.
Because
it's really exploding energy.
Because the high nickel yields are, you really have to do something different. And that one's what? It's 3-sorb or almost 3-sorb as a nickel?
It's 3 or 4. It's supposed to be.
Or 5.
It may have interaction. One doesn't know. My point was.
Does that system have high velocities?
You should see the spectra. The spectra are really strange. There's no feature in those spectra. I mean, that one spectra basically that we've got. It doesn't look like.
You're saying they're so broad that they're not there?
Either, or there are no lines. So it's something we've been working on for maybe 5 years. We can't get a model that matches those, either like a spectra.
I guess if I wanted to turn Sri's question around, I mean, maybe the way to ask the question differently is in a large local sample of 1Bs, 1Cs that's now happening because people are looking. At what point does it become an embarrassment that you haven't found evidence for, you know, out of that 1B, 1C sample, that you haven't found evidence for?
Well, Sri's got 100 objects.
That's what I'm saying. But the point is, is that an issue? Is that a constraining? You know, at what point does it become a constraint? I mean, I think
I've tried to mention those before. I mean, once we have, maybe 100 is not enough, but we'll have 200 soon. Once we don't get anything out of 200, there'll be a problem.
But that's because 1 in 100 are hypernovae from the velocities. Is that why you say it's 1 in 100? That's what I'm trying to understand.
I would say probably a few out of the 100 would be hypernovae that they will see.
Because
these are bound by their magnitude. So out of the 100, 5 or 6.
then you need 1 in 1,000 or 2,000 supernovae 1BC to produce a gamma ray burst. That's the higher end of the estimate. So for the so-called universal structure gap model, you need an even smaller fraction. So if you don't see even 1 out of 100 and you expect 1 out of 1,000 or less, then it shouldn't be that surprising. You can still have a distribution of events. Not all of them would produce 10 to 51 ergs in Lorentz factor of 100 or more. Some of them would have a major Lorentz factor and a smaller energy. You should at a certain point start seeing those as well. And these observations can definitely be constrained at. But at this point, we shouldn't fall off our seats.
No, there's a comment I wanted to make about these, because this plot is, I think, misleading. Those two red dots are not the gamma ray burst supernovae, are they? They're the ones that Alicia looked at in her paper.
Those are
the GMB supernovae?
Yeah, they're probably with the spectrum.
I mean, I cannot sort of name these things, but I know that at least two of these supposedly bright, and I don't know which two they are, 1Bs, at least for one of them, there has been a comment in the paper that I think Alicia got the information from, saying, given that the light curve and the spectra are so similar to 94i, we assume, this is what I think Locchiati said in his paper, we can infer that the mass of the ejector was similar, so of the order of one solar mass. Now to assume that out of that one solar mass in the ejector, about 0.8 was nickel 56 is a bit different. I don't know what that may mean, but what I'm saying is that with such few numbers.
Top plot, I think, at least in my mind, these sorts of things are always rough. For me, it's more impressive because it's a very simple thing. Peak luminosity, peak luminosity. It's in a game which is.
So, what if this is a type 1A? I mean, how do you know this is not a type 1A? That's what I'm getting at.
Which ones? The yellows or the
blacks? I don't know which ones. There's the GAB less bright 1Bs.
Yeah.
They may be 1A.
I don't know. We can sit down. I'm saying the.
And that's why he was quoting that statement, because the only 1As you make have to eject a
nickel 56. These are all local 1BC, yellow versus red, and they're not different.
Right, but if, as I say, if I call some of these 1As and they're gone, then things change. So, given that we only have so few objects, it is important what they are individually.
So
once we have more, then of course.
Tell me, but if these two curves are similar, then normal scientific common sense says one shouldn't start with the more elaborate theory.
Suppose you take the same number, the same supernova you've plotted here and GRBs and plot the other properties like radio, X-ray, spectral, velocity, whatever. Do you still get a complete intermingling? Like it is a separate evidence?
It's very clear that the GRB triggers. Objects are very, very bright in X-ray and radio on any time scale, at any effort.
Even at long times? Like, I don't know how long you've followed it. Maybe.
In radio, they long.
In radio?
Hundreds of days, yeah.
Okay, and they still?
Yeah.
No, but they're bright for supernovae, but not necessarily bright for GABs, are they?
Yeah, so the brightness of supernovae people study for 10,000 days.
Certain points here. You're not doing any
stuff,
no, that's fine. I know. But he's just saying that this is what you have. Though. I mean, there's not much you can do more. But
cosmologists do statistics on 4. We have plenty. We have 3 times.
How does one make a solar mass worth a nickel from any commonsensical GRB central engine? I mean, how does that work?
You work with Sam. Sam should answer this. Well, the synthesis of nickel 56 in the collapse model is supposed to take place mostly in this wind, which sets up right after the collapse. So it doesn't seem to be a big problem in that framework to produce about one solar mass of nickel. I think it may not be so easy to produce 3 or 4. But then again, you know.
What's the name of the supernova that's bright
end? Am I allowed? 99 AS.
99?
AS.
We're only hearing about it now?
Ask Peter Nugent.
Makes it 99.
99, yeah, yeah.
7 years ago. 7 years ago.
He's been analyzing data.
So when you get something with, you know, four solar masses nickel in it, you decide maybe it's not right for a while.
Well, I mean, that's one reason that he's being so slow. I mean, that's a big number. So.
Yeah, how is he getting, how are the nickel running to Scott?
Not the
point. Yeah, how do you go from the bottom plot to the top plot?
Just how are you getting the nickel abundances?
The nickel comes, and I've, it's just a peak brightness of the light.
So it's not really a reliable nickel.
Yeah.
Well, there's an assumption on the distance, which on the average you may get it right, fine.
And there's an assumption on the emission mechanism as well.
Well, as long as the light curve, as Sri says, looks like that of a supernova, I think I can fairly assume that the emission mechanism is the same. I mean, I think
well, it's a bump in an afterglow like
the bump in 1 month. I mean, the stance of two or three magnitudes is likely to be something that might be of this, yes. It doesn't look like your typical 1C thing. It looks more like it goes up and does this, and then one of those funny ones. So one possibility, one interpretation that's being put forward is that there may be a significant contribution from interaction of the ejector with certain stellar material, right?
Not in essence, 50% interaction
would be very small. So this 4 would only go down to 3 at most. But it's a funny beast. I mean, it's not an easy case.
We have to wait for final answer next month.
Excuse me, how much does this whole model depend on metallicity of the original star? Because that would change the relationship between final core mass and what the original mass was.
It depends, yes. Basically, the plot I showed you is here. You can interpret it as zero. That makes it as much. There is some assumption. Metallicity can come in.
Because I might imagine that that could be an explanation for the cosmological gamma ray burst, because it sets more than one. I would expect basically all the progenitors to be low metallicity stars.
So if you go to low metallicity, that plot gets better. It keeps better.
Sign that it's time to go.
More discussions? Or? I think Sri's report is just posing a lot of questions for the theorists. How to make nickel and how to get quarterback of nickel onto black hole. So I don't have a program to get small amount of nickel in the energetic problem because of the properties and properties. And they're not so easy to make lots of nickel if the energetic problem is not so high. So the normal ones have 1BC and bright ones, I have a problem. But energetic one with small nickel, you could get all the fallback in the equator of the reaction. But I have not much problem. It's a very, very important, of course.